We're going to, wherever we are, we're going to break for session at 10:30, and we'll come back after session to finish the agenda. But the priority will be today the pension bills. The first we have is the omnibus pension bill of Senator Betzold. Senator Betzold, Senate file 2918. Senator Betzold moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. I should point out to members that we have established a quorum for action. So,
Mr. Chair, just let me just describe some procedural background here. As you know, the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement is a five-member commission of the House and the Senate. I'm the chair of it for this two-year period. And we've been working actually since the session ended last year to prepare this year's pensions bill. And I've actually got three bills on the agenda. One is an omnibus pension bill, so that's Senate File 2918, which includes all the provisions that we're going to be talking about. There's a lot of policy in here. I'm not going to go through that today, but if members have any questions on it, you've got a summary here. We've got the people here who can ask about it. I'll be focusing on the fiscal issues. There are other provisions in this bill that do have fiscal impacts, and one is dealing with MRF, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. That's not only in 2518, but it's a separate bill, Senate File 2644. So the same provisions are in 2644 that are in the omnibus bill. I've got another bill, Senate File 2573, which affects the three major funds, MSRS, TRA, PRA, and then St. Paul Booth and Teachers. That's in the omnibus bill and it's a separate bill. And the reason why is, frankly, because, you know, coming out of the Pension Commission, I didn't know if I need to send one of these bills to the tax committee for looking for levy authority. It is my hope that if the bills pass, I could pass actually all three to the floor. I would only be focusing on the omnibus bill. But frankly, you know, not knowing just how things twist and turn around this place, if the omnibus bill gets in trouble, I may need a secondary bill, a pension bill, to proceed to get some of the work done that's been we've worked on for this past year. So just so members are aware why we've got three bills on, but the focus is going to be on the omnibus bill, which is Senate File 2918. And to deal with the fiscal issues in here, there's a number of factors I have to talk about to put it in context. Members need to understand that how pensions are funded. Pensions are funded mainly by employer and employee contributions for the active employees. That is somebody who's got a job in government. So the employer, whichever level it is, whether state or local government or school districts, the employer pays a share towards the pension, as does each employee pay towards the pension. The money gets invested, and the investment is really where we see a lot of the income coming into the pension fund. After the employee retires, the employer and employee share stops because the person's not working anymore, so there's that income ends, and so it's only the investments after that. That's a key component to understand as we try to understand the other the fund issues. The biggest issue we've got before us today is MRF, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. It is an old fund. It's about 90 years old, and it was established back again before people were really cognizant of pension issues, before they understood pension issues. Anybody who worked in the city of Minneapolis was in MRF. If you worked for the city of Minneapolis, if you worked for the Minneapolis School Board as a teacher, if you worked for Hennepin County, if you worked for the Sewer District, the Minneapolis Airport, the Airports Commission, everybody there was in MRF. About 30 years ago, the legislature decided that that fund really wasn't functional and working the way we wanted pension funds to work, so they closed it out, which means that the people that were then in MRF stayed in that fund, and those that are alive are still in that fund today. New employees were then put into the PERA fund, which is for all other local employees throughout the state. But the MRF fund, by being closed out, that meant that as people retired out of that fund, it meant that the employer and employee contributions stopped for each one of those individuals. Today, there are slightly more than 100 active employees still in MRF. Every one of them is getting very close to retirement. There's about 5,000 retirees in MRF. And, of course, as retirees, they're not paying into it. The employer isn't paying into it because it's a closed fund. It's getting to the point where it's in real big trouble. And I should stress, too, that when I'm talking about the retirees, they don't all live in the city of Minneapolis. They live all over the place. They live throughout the state of Minnesota and beyond. So they're retirees. They've earned their pension. The fund is in trouble. It's expected to run out of money, frankly, between 5 and 7 years. This fund was not coordinated with Social Security because it predates Social Security. That means that these individuals didn't pay into Social Security. If this fund goes broke, they don't have Social Security to fall on. They've got nothing, which means that they become, I guess, wards of the state or something. This is a troublesome situation. How they got there, there's numerous factors that we can talk about. It doesn't change the ultimate problem of it, but just for the committee's benefit, again, the source of income has dropped, employees. The state of Minnesota and the other major employees have been contributing to keep to the fund over recent years. The state of Minnesota has a $9 million standing appropriation we've made in the state government budget bill, which I've been carrying the past few years. The city of Minneapolis has been making contributions. The $9 million paid for by the state is more than half of what the fund has been getting in recent years. As recently as January, the actuaries told us that they would need, in the near future, $90 million from some source for a number of years in order to make themselves whole. Now, again, the fund, although it's running out of money, you can structure the new money coming in over a period of years. The less money you put in is going to stretch out the time period under which it has to be paid off. Ultimately, whatever amount of money goes into the fund is going to start decreasing because as the members start dying off, we're going to be paying less. So it isn't structured so that the last MRF member is going to win the lottery. I mean, it's going to be diminishing. But it's still going to be a significant amount of money to keep the fund afloat for a number of years. The actuary assumptions have changed over the years. I mean, some of these people were working back in the 50s and 60s and even in the 70s, the assumptions were that they would probably be dying off by age 65 or 70. Well, some of these people are now 100 years old. Some of these retirees have been retired longer than they ever worked. It was set up so that people could work 30 years and retire. So somebody started working at age 20, could retire at age 50. Or in any event, they could retire at age 60 because that's how it was set up years and years ago. But again, how it was set up and the rules under which they worked are rules that we have to abide by right now because those were the promises that were made back then. The stock market obviously has affected the stability of MRF. As recently as 2001, they were close to 100% funded. They're certainly not in that situation now because the stock market has dropped. That's where the investments went. There was some mismanagement of the fund. There was a former executive director, former state senator, who made some bad loans, made some bad investments. It cost the fund a considerable amount of money. Again, those are just parts of the history that, what's caused the fund to be in trouble today. In order to put the fund on a stable and sustainable rate, as I said, we have to increase the contribution. The state's been paying $9 million. A proposal has been made, and it's part of this bill, that all the everybody's been contributing will contribute a proportional larger share to MRF. We haven't got the money in this biennium to do that. We all recognize that. So starting in the next biennium, the state under this bill would be paying $27.5 million a year in addition to the $9 million that we are currently paying as the state's share. Now, why does the state have to pay anything? The state's the one who set the rules. The legislature, for whatever reason, we decided how much to close out the fund. We've decided what the contributions were to be. We set the rules on up, and so the state has some interest in making sure that the fund stays stable. And as I say, the alternative, if the fund fails, ultimately becomes a state funding issue anyway. The other combined entities would be paying their share as well, too, which would total about, I believe, $22 million. The contribution increases, these funding increases would start in fiscal year 2013, that is in July of 2012. As I say, and it's a commitment, if we make the commitment, this isn't something we can say that this biennium, well, we'll make the commitment and then come back next year and visit it, revisit it. There are, as again, a lot of retirees that are frankly scared. They're afraid that their fund is going to go bankrupt. They have nothing, and they would like to see a commitment from the legislature and from the governor that we're going to do whatever we can to help save this fund. It's a bad situation. It's an awkward situation, but it's one we simply can't ignore. Mr. Chair, let me stop at that on MRF because there's other issues I need to talk about that are not related to MRF, but this is probably the biggest part of the package you have before you.
And I think members are aware that, again, as Senator Betzel has pointed out, in the budget right now we have the $9 million state share. So that's accounted for. There is no new money for MRF presented in this bill for this biennium. It clearly is a significant tail commitment for the next biennium and biennium subsequent to that. So obviously, when we see the November forecast, it would reflect legislative action, if affirmative, during this year's session. So questions on the MRF provision from members?
Okay. And Mr. Chair, the other provisions actually deal with the bulk of this 37-page fiscal note. And it's one of the other bills that I've got, Senate File 2573, which is also part of the omnibus bill. And that deals with the three major funds, which is the Minnesota State Retirement MSRS services. That is the state employees fund, PERA, Public Employees Retirement Association. That's the local employees, state and county, for instance, and corrections, that's police and fire. And then TRA, which are all the teachers in the state, except for those in St. Paul and Duluth, they have their separate funds. And St. Paul and teachers are also in this particular bill. Each one of the funds has some long-range issues that need to be addressed. They try to come in with a common solution for them, even though there's differences within the funds. And I'll describe each fund kind of where they're at and what is needed. But overall, what they're generally looking for are increases from the employer and the employees, except for the MSRS general. They're not in that particular situation right now, but in the long run, they may need that. But employer and employee contribution increases would be needed, which when you consider the employees, that means they're paying more out of their paycheck. When you consider the employer, that means that the governmental entity that hires them, whether it's the school district, the local government, or the state, would be paying more. We're going to be limiting the cost of living increases for the current retirees. And frankly, one of the things that happened back in the 90s was that inflation had been eating away at the pensions, and so we made some significant increases in the cost of living for the retirees. And those have, frankly, eaten away at the funds. So we're going to be reducing the cost of increases for retirees. This is a shared sacrifice. Everybody's going to be part of it. We've also got some minor issues that do affect people. I mean, people who are deferring their pensions, they're retired, but they're not drawing on their pensions, are going to get a lower interest rate, as an example. But they came about for a number of reasons. Number one, of course, the stock market, because the investments are drawing much less. We assume in statute that the funds are going to get an 8.5% return on their investments. Actually, this past year, some of the funds did do quite well on their investments, but if you assume that they're going to get 8.5% over, say, the next 30 years, and that doesn't happen, these funds are in big trouble, and some would go broke before the 30 years are out. Again, actuarial assumptions have changed, too. I mean, people are living longer. In some instances, people retired too early when they're, say, the rule of 90. And all those things, as a combination of things, come back and causes the stress on the funds. MSRS, the Minnesota State Retirement System, is in the best shape, I think, overall, the general plan. But even they, in 2007, they were about 99% funded. When you looked at what they needed down the road. As of June last year, 2009, they were 66% funded. In 2 years, it went from 99% to 66% funded. But as I say, they're in the best shape, except they've got some subgroups underneath them. One is the State Patrol. That's at 55%, and it is in trouble. The State Patrol plan is a newer plan. It also allows people to retire at age 55. And because, again, when you work in certain positions like corrections, law enforcement, State Patrol, you just can't be doing the job, you know, when you get into your 60s. So we do allow them to be doing, because you need to be young and physical in order to do these positions. But so the State Patrol actually is looking for an employer and employee contribution increase. And if you look at the fiscal note, and actually the bill as we came before you was actually looking for about $7 million in this biennium to help that fund. We recognize that's not going to happen. So the only option was employer and employee contribution increase. I'll call your attention to the fiscal notes of Department of Public Safety, DNR, and Corrections, where they're saying not only the contribution increases, but an increase of 10% in their employer contributions would cause significant layoffs, they believe, in their departments in order to make those their contribution increases. That is a problem, obviously, with those departments. And we've already made serious budget cuts here. But again, if you delay making the decisions this year and you come back next year and say we'll do it then, it just means that you've got less time and a bigger debt, which means a bigger fiscal problem to deal with. So I don't know of any other way out to get this taken care of. But as I say, for MSRS, the bigger problem is in the State Patrol plan. I should note, as you will note in there, some other plans are probably less funded. If you look at, I think, page 5 of the fiscal note, the corrections plan is 62% funded. I mentioned State Patrol, 55.62%. The judges plan is 47.43% funded. So there are issues that are going on out there, but that's the issue on MSRS. I will comment in a little while on a provision in the MSRS plan dealing with legislators and the unclassified plan, but I'd like to have that as a separate discussion after I talk about PERA and TRA. So, Mr. Chair, maybe I can pause here and see if there's anybody wants to weigh in on the MSRS portion of this before I talk about PERA and TRA.
Questions from the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair, then, PERA, again, is the local employees. They're around 70% funded. Their actuary told them that if they had a 12% interest return for the next 10 years, they would not lose ground. In other words, you'd need 12% return on your investments to stay where you're at. If they don't get that, the problem is going to get worse for them. And again, some of their employees had rule of 90, which meant that they retired back in their mid to late 50s, retired too early. Again, people are living too long. Actuarial assumptions. The fund does need help, and it needs it now. They are proposing a employer and employee contribution increases. This for the employers, that means your cities and counties, and we're talking about property taxes. And given the fact that we've cut local government aids because of all the government programs that have been shifted onto the property taxes, this is going to add more stress to the local government's budgets and to property taxes to do this. However, the groups at the Capitol that represent the local governments have said they recognize the problem. They realize that they're going to have to increase that and also have reduced the cost of living for retirees in order to make this happen. One of the employee groups, AFSCME, was originally opposed to this, and rightly so, because you have employees that in some instances have had no pay raises for 2 years. And so if you make them pay more for their pension, it's a pay cut. They reluctantly support this because they recognize that there's a serious problem that needs to be addressed sooner than later. So PERA has their proposal before you to increase the employer and employee contributions. TRA is probably in the worst shape of the major funds. These are all the teachers statewide, with the exception of St. Paul and Duluth. They're at 59% fund, about close to 60%. The assumption is that the actuaries are saying they would run out of money by the year 2032, which is about 22 years from now. Some of their members got the rule of 90, which was people in the system up until 1989. What they would propose to do is have a phase-in of 0.5% for the employer and employee over a four-year period. So it would be up to 2% over 4 years. And again, school districts, although the School Boards Association, I believe, is supportive of this, that doesn't necessarily mean that every school district is going to be supportive of it. In fact, they're going to say, where are we going to get the money out of our budgets, given the fact that we really haven't had any new money for K-12, and they don't have levy authority in this bill to go to the property taxes. So this is going to cause more stress on school budgets. The Education Minnesota, I've been advised, and they can speak for themselves, obviously, that they had some concerns about this. I don't believe that they are now standing in the way of this proposal. I'm not sure that they're thrilled with it, but I think they understand the severity of the problem. And again, delaying it is going to make it worse. St. Paul teachers and Duluth teachers are also in this bill. They have similar proposals for the employer and employee contribution increases, no levy authority. Let me stop there before I talk about legislators and unclassified plan. Is there any?
Senator Betzel, with TRA, yeah. Can you offer some sense of a dollar amount to school districts in terms of the employer contribution?
I don't know that I can. Mr. Martin, here's or probably with Mr. Thompson. Ms. Hacking? Okay.
Ms. Hacking, if you could just identify yourself.
Laurie Hacking, TRA Executive Director. In terms of the impact on school districts, it's approximately $21 million in the first year of the phase-in, and then as it escalates, it would be approaching about $90 million or so by the fourth year of the phase-in.
So for the large districts, Anoka, Hennepin, Minneapolis, is that, say, a $2 million share? I mean, not looking for an exact figure, but just some sense what kind of proportion goes to the districts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. We don't have it broken down on a per school district basis. We had a rough approximation that when fully phased in, this is something that would represent approximately 1 to 1.5% of an average school district budget.
Okay.
But that's a rough approximation. We weren't able to do a district by district breakdown.
But that would be when it's fully phased in.
Right.
And is the 1 to 1.5% based on current appropriations for a district?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 1.5% is their payroll costs, their actual wages paid to teachers. It's a half.
So they'll reflect whatever the number of teachers would be at whatever
right,
time.
Right, and their salary levels
okay.
as well.
Okay, that just gives me a bit of an idea. Other questions on the TRA portion?
Mr. Chair, then if I could revert back to my discussion on MSRS, Article 4 of the bill deals with a group, the unclassified employees. Again, for people who may not be well-versed in pension issues, most government employees are what are called defined benefit plans. That is, they're career employees in most cases. For every year that you work, you get what's called a multiplier. You get a little percentage in there. And then when it comes time to compute your pension, you usually look at the top 5 years of your salary, average them out, and the percentage multiplied by that average comes to some formula which decides how much your pension is going to be. There are, like anything in pensions, there's unfairness throughout it. I mean, you can have two teachers that work teaching the same subject, same grade, different school districts. One gets paid more because it's a more wealthy district. One's in a poor district. and they're going to have a difference in the pensions because it's all driven by how much you made. But that's just how pensions work. But the defined benefit plan, as I say, is for most people who are on a career track, and it just the number of years you've worked, the amount of money you make is going to determine your pension. But we have a number of other people, and the people who work for the legislature, our staff, are an example of that. There are people who come and work for the government for a few years, and that's it. Then they move on to something else. When you look around, for instance, the legislature, the Minnesota Senate, not a lot of people, our staff, actually retire out of here when you consider all the people that come and go out of this place. I'd guess for every person actually serves a full, you know, for 30, 40 years or whatever and actually retires, there's probably at least 100 people, probably many more, that don't. It's just there's a lot of turnover. But we have to recognize the fact that they should be earning something for their pension, for their retirement, for the years that they serve here, however long or short it is. So for people that are in this track where they're not expected to be here for a long, long period of time, we have, and this is not just the legislature, this is other areas of government, but this is the biggest example I can give. This unclassified plan is where they can come on in, they serve a few years, they leave, and they can take something with them. It's kind of like a 401k plan. It's not the defined benefit. It's going to be they invest the money in. Money is taken out of their paycheck. The employer and the employee contribute to that. It's invested. And the employee actually has a say as to whether you wanted a high-risk investment or low-risk or have the State Board investment invested. But it's invested for that employee. And when the employee moves on, that money can follow the employee. And we have a glitch in the law that deals with the people, particularly legislative employees, who are in the unclassified service. If they've served 10 years, after 10 years, at any point after 10 years, they can say they'd rather get out of the unclassified plan and move over into the defined benefit plan. But they don't have to make it at 10 years or at any point until they retire. When they get right to retirement, in fact, the day before retirement, they can say, okay, I will look at one plan or the other. I'll go defined benefit or I'll stay on unclassified, which is what's called defined contribution. The amount that you're going to get in defined contribution is depending on how your investments work. That's really bad pension policy. Most pension policies say at some point early on, you have to make a decision and you stick with that decision until you retire. But this one, they can choose which plan after 10 years, which one they want to go in. It's difficult, probably impossible for us to take current employees and take a benefit away from them unless you give them a new benefit. So I don't know how you can close that loophole for current employees, but we can certainly affect future employees. What this plan would do is that for future unclassified employees is say they have 7 years to decide which plan they want to be in. If they want to, they would start in the unclassified plan. If they want to stay that way the whole time they're here and beyond, that's their choice. But if they come into the legislature and during that 7 years they decide, I'd rather be defined benefit plan, they can make that choice. But when they make that choice, they're going to stay with that choice however long they're here. There's advantages and there's disadvantages to both plans. But if one really feels strongly they all want to be one track as opposed to the other, this bill would allow future employees to do that. Again, it doesn't affect current employees. As to legislators, the current law had legislators elected through the 1996 election were in an old legislator's plan, which was a defined benefit plan that was for legislators only. And we closed that out for any new legislators. So people who were in that plan are still in that plan unless they opted to change over. In 1990, legislators elected after 1996 were all put into a defined contribution unclassified plan, the very same plan that our staff are in. Those people elected prior to 96 were given the option of switching over. Just for public disclosure, I made that choice. I switched over to be in the MSRS unclassified plan. And a few other legislators did, but again, that's just an individual choice. For legislators who are elected after 96, and those of us who switched over to the unclassified plan, they do not have the option of switching over to a defined benefit plan after 10 years, unlike our staff. Now, over the years, we've heard some complaints that there's been some unfairness of that. Well, again, it's a bad pension policy to allow people to go to retirement and decide which plan they want to be in. You've got to make the plan early on. What this bill would do for legislators that are in the unclassified plan, it doesn't affect those in a defined benefit plan at all. For legislators in the unclassified plan, they would have, it's 1 year, 1 year to decide to switch over to defined benefit. They can stay in the unclassified plan, they can switch over to defined benefit plan if they choose to do so. Again, there's advantages and disadvantages to both of them, but if they want to do that, they would do that. For new legislators, they would have the same requirement as the staff would have. That is, they'd have up to 7 years to decide, do you want to be an unclassified or defined benefit, defined contribution to defined benefit? Choose one, but whichever one you have, you're going to stick with it. So, again, the effect on legislators in here is are only affected those who are in the unclassified defined contribution plan. That is, those elected after 96 or those who chose to go in there. And then they could have 1 year to go into the defined benefit plan for whatever reason they want to do that. That's how it affects legislators. Now, there would be a contribution increase for legislators in the defined contribution plan, just as we're affecting employer-employee contributions. I could have Mr. Bergstrom describe how that is, because I don't know if it's going to affect many people here, but it's going to affect people, our colleagues who have been elected since 96. Mr. Chair, that, in a nutshell, is the bill. I do have a technical amendment.
Senator Betzel, let me just ask a couple of questions then about what you just described. You keep on talking about the legislative staff, but this article affects all unclassifieds, not just legislative staff.
Right, yeah. I give that as an example because, these are the people we see, but it's all unclassified. Yes.
So in this committee, we've had conversations about unclassified employees.
Yes.
So what's the universe of unclassified employees that would include legislative staff, state unclassified? Do you know roughly?
Well, Mr. Bergstrom from the MSRS director can. And I'll ask that the technical amendment be passed out at this time, too. So.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the state retirement system. The unclassified plan has roughly 1,500 current participating employees. It includes legislative staff, and then for other state agencies, it's usually agency heads or deputy agency heads. And then there are, like, a lot of the State Board of Investment staff are in the plan. So it's a fairly limited group that participate, generally ones that may not have as much control over their employment as others or have a shorter employment trend.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, then on the chart, which column, Mr. Bergstrom, is that on the chart?
Mr. Chair, if you look at page 86 to
could somebody 80, hand oh good.
Sorry. If you look at page 86 to 86 of the first engrossment, that's basically the list of everybody who's in that plan.
Okay. And Senator Betzold, then relative so right now an unclassified employee, putting aside legislators, an unclassified employee can at any time opt to go into the defined benefit plan or make that change the day before retirement?
Under this bill, yes. If they're in the unclassified plan, they would have 1 year to make a decide.
In terms of putting aside legislators.
Yes.
Right now, any unclassified.
Oh, any unclassified has that opportunity right now.
Okay. But what about somebody who hypothetically has served 6 years as a commissioner for Governor X and 15 years later serves for 4 years as Commissioner Y, Commissioner for Governor Y? Can that person with bifurcated service do the same thing?
Or is it Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, so, and if they've left state employment, so their years of unclassified service are in past years, and now they retire at age 70 from whatever they're doing in the private sector, do they have that option at that point?
Mr. Chair, under current law, they have to choose within 30 days of termination. So they couldn't leave and then leave their money in MSRS and then switch at a later point. So you have to do it essentially just after you terminate your state employment.
So if they serve a duration, again, as a commissioner for one governor, and they think, maybe I'll do this again, they would get that opportunity, but if they never come back.
Mr. Chair, then they would not get another opportunity. If they don't come back, they would not get another opportunity to switch.
Okay, and I'm sorry, how long is it after they terminate state service?
30 days.
Okay.
But for the people who stay in until they retire, then they can make the switch any time.
Yeah. And so what your bill does is put everybody on a uniform schedule that they have 7 years?
7 years, yep. At any time during the 7 years, you can decide to switch over to defined benefit. You start an unclassified defined contribution. That's the default. If you decide to switch over to defined benefit on day one, you can do that. You can do it any, but after, within that 7 year, if you do nothing, you stay in the unclassified from then on.
Okay, so this hypothetical doesn't work, but let's take Governor Plenty because he's going to complete two terms of as governor. That's 8 years. So if I'm a commissioner, let's say a future two-term governor, if I end up being a commissioner for the entirety of the two terms, I would have to make that decision a year before the governor's term expires. If you assume I'm leaving with the governor.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct because they would have to make that choice before the end of before their seventh year.
Okay. And so this provision would put everybody on the same schedule, legislators, legislative staff, unclassified, the entire 1,500.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, except it does not affect current employees. They are grandparented under the old rules. So,
with the assumption that if you took that benefit away, you'd have to add a benefit. Is that?
Mr. Chair.
That was the problem we got in because I can't. The current unclassified employees have that right to make that decision after 10 years. And unless I found some way to give them a different benefit, which I can't right now, I have to leave the current law as it is. This only affects future employees. And we should stress that constitutional officers, a future governor could serve two terms, and he doesn't get that choice. If the people who work for him would be in the classified service.
And in terms of the legislative part of it, this would allow some people the one-year look back.
The legislators who were put into the unclassified plan with no opportunity to go to defined benefit would be given that limited opportunity if they chose to do so. But it's only that group that are currently in the pipeline that would have that.
So that wouldn't affect, say, somebody like myself then?
If you are presumably in the old plan that was closed out through 1996, if you didn't switch out of that one, this doesn't affect you at all.
Okay. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Papley.
I'm sorry, I never got an answer to my question. Maybe
sorry.
It's Mr. Martin that did the chart. I'm just wondering where the unclassified people are on the chart under MSRS.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, they are not listed on the chart. This is just defined benefit plans.
Okay.
What would their cost of living adjustment would be affected along with this. Currently, they get 2.5%. They, too, would get a 2% cost of living adjustment.
All right, thanks.
But this is more defined benefit plan.
Okay.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, to any of you, is the unclassified defined contribution plan coordinated with Social Security?
Yes. Which was one of the problems with the old legislator's plan, which was not.
Right.
So, no, that's one of the reasons why, because it is coordinated with Social Security, yes.
Sir, I don't know if you... So what would happen if a legislator transferred from the unclassified defined plan to the defined contribution plan, what would happen with their Social Security contribution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, the plan that they would roll into is also combined with Social Security. So their Social Security coverage would continue. It's the current legislators that were hired before 97, they do not have Social Security unless they decided to participate. So they would really be switching from the unclassified plan is coordinated with Social Security as well as our general plan is coordinated with Social Security. So it really wouldn't change their Social Security coverage.
Senator Tomasoni.
And Mr. Chairman, I was just looking at the fiscal note on Article 4, and the fifth bullet point says the modifications to the unclassified plan will have long-term savings impact on the general plan because individuals will have a limited period to elect the general plan coverage, and two, the additional contributions to the plan will increase plan balances and decrease the number of conversions to the general plan. So it actually looks like it's saving money according to the fiscal note.
And Mr. Chair, maybe I should be clear. We've been working on this for quite a while, and we're trying to think about in terms of 1 year, but we actually had a date certain, which is January 1 of 2011, when people, legislators who want to make the transition, so it's not going to be a full year. Current legislators who are in the unclassified plan would have until January 1 of 2011 to make that option. So as the clock is ticking, if this bill becomes law, so.
Well, one more thing, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking at parity with the legislators in the defined benefit plan and the others. They're also seeing a reduction in their COLA from 2.5% to 2% along with the other plans. So I wanted to make sure that legislators were also taking that reduction, that pension reduction.
Yes.
Okay. Further questions on this section? Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, we have a technical amendment, the 9A amendment. Most of it is technical. There is a provision on the 9A amendment that PERA requested based upon their discussions with their actuary, and this deals with the post. Okay. And maybe perhaps Mr. Martin would be in a better position to kind of go through the provision in the 9A amendment. So.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, members, the 9A amendment does a couple of different things. The bulk of the language that you see relates to the state patrol plan. Senator Betzel indicated that the employer contribution increase for the state patrol was being downsized from roughly 10% of pay down to, I think, 3% of pay. And that language is in the early part of the amendment. That's the lines 1.2 through 1.4, I think. There is some new language having to do with the post-retirement increases for the state patrol plan. They're being downsized a bit more than the other MSRS plans, and that's what's being done in that language. The provision that PERA requested having to do with post-retirement interest rate assumptions is on page 2, lines 4 through 15. There is an omission, an intended deletion of two lines has been left out. Mr. Watson caught this. It would be on between page 2.20 and 2.21. Page 143, lines 27 and 28 should be deleted. That was the Gremlins got the document, unfortunately. That has to do with an extended.
Are the Gremlins in classified or unclassified?
hopefully these are unclassified Gremlins.
They're probably in this community.
This has to do with the early retirement incentive that's being revitalized in this bill, and it was pointed out by House Research that there may be some age discrimination issues with the language, and this deletes that offending, a potentially offending provision.
Again, maybe Mr. Watson can tell us what we need to do to modify the amendment. Otherwise, I would move it. So.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I think it is on the copies that have been handed out. It's after page 2, after line 20, insert page 143, delete lines 27 and 28.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. I'll move the, I guess, 9A amendment then.
Okay. As further discussion on the 9A amendment. If there's no further, Senator Higgins.
Move your mic.
You probably still can't hear me anyway. I think it was in the newspaper maybe last week about the corrections plan being possibly discriminatory because of the some lawsuit that's been going on. Does this handwritten insertion deal with that issue?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I believe that was dealing with insurance issues, and which is not separate from this. The insurance is something that was it's a collectively bargained thing between the administration and the bargaining units. This is something you may remember a year or so ago where we reduced the time period in which you could work for corrections and get a vested pension. And we sent that down to 3 years.
Yeah.
So now, if you work for 3 years, you're not going to get much of a pension. But the way that the agreements have been made over the years was that the administration agreed to pay for 10 years of health care benefits.
Well, that's what it was.
After you retired. So people were going to work for correction for just 3 years, getting squat for a pension, but getting a really nice health care benefits. Now, the vesting period has been changed in this particular bill, but that's different. I mean, it's a retirement issue, but it's not a pension issue.
Okay. And
so that's not affected by this.
The vesting period for corrections is now going to be
Is it 10?
Or 10.
I think we sent that to 10 now.
10.
For new hires. Again, we can't affect the current employees, but new hires would have 10 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions on the 9A amendment? Okay. Senator Batzold has moved it. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, that kind of completes my presentation. I know there's a number of people here who care about these issues, and I've learned that people who care about these issues care about them a lot, but I don't know if anybody here is to testify or have any issues or concerns they want to raise.
Okay.
We dealt with that, as I said, most of this within the Pensions Commission, and so but we're here.
Okay, we haven't been notified of anybody who wishes to testify.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pearson.
I would just make one comment. Your question about gremlins or your reference to gremlins, I think the gremlins occur in this committee. I think we are the gremlins here.
But they're defined benefit.
Depending on when they were elected.
For the damage doers here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if there are no questions or if nobody wishes to be heard, do I have anything else I need to do? Do I have anything else I need to do? Okay. Just making sure. I'd like to have Senate File 2918 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay. On Senator Betzold's motion.
Oops. Article 4, Mr. Watson? We're going to hold off for that.
On Senator Betzold's motion, if there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, Betzold. I'd like to move the other two bills here. The MRF bill, I think we could, again, there's a cost here, but I just want to get the bills to the floor. It's not my intention to take them up unless the omnibus bill runs into trouble and I need a second bill. So I'd like to move Senate File 2644. Whatever engrossment it is.
First, Senator Betzold moves adoption of the division report.
Okay,
all those
yes.
in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. So, Senator Betzold, this bill is.
It's only MRF.
But it's the same that.
Exactly the same as what was in the omnibus bill that we just adopted.
Okay. Is there further discussion on Senate File 2644? If not, Senator Betzold moves Senate File 2644 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
Aye.
Motion carries.
And then 2573, that's the TRA, PERA, MSRS, and St. Paul Duluth Teachers Bill. I'd move the division report on that bill.
Okay, on the motion for adoption of the division report, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, we adopted the 9A amendment to Senate File 2918. We don't have an amendment quite prepared to that, but it would be the same language. So I'd like to move that however it fits, the 9A amendment also be incorporated within 2573 because it's the same provisions.
Mr. Watson, do you know where it would go in the bill?
We'll find it out, but as well take
we'll
care
find
of
it.
That's what they said before.
I haven't done it yet.
Well, Senator Betzold, this is a little bit awkward. Your intent is not necessarily to take this bill up on the floor.
No. But
if that's the case, you want the amendment to be adopted now.
Yes. I need a vehicle on the floor, but I just want to make sure if it gets to the floor, if something happens down the road, that at least it's in the same shape as the other bill that left here, and we don't have any gremlins, classified or unclassified. Or, again, it's not my intention to actually move on it. If it's anything, it's going to be a vehicle, so it doesn't matter to me if I move it to the floor amended or unamended, Mr. Chair.
Well, we can – I think the motion would be that if you want to move adoption of the 9A amendment with instructions to council to place that amendment in the appropriate section of the bill.
Yes.
Okay. So on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2573 as amended be recommended to pass.
And so, again, that's exactly what we've just passed. All
right.
All right. On Senator Bessel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Bessel and Mr. Martin. Senator Scheid.
And we did the Murph one, too. We passed. This is very interesting. You'd have much problem in finance committee.
We have Senate File 2170.
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, you heard this bill last year, and it was passed by the House and the Senate. The governor vetoed it. It's the homeowner lender mediation legislation, and I think that we've done a really good job of resolving some of the issues that the governor had and that some of the stakeholders have. You know, we've done quite a few things in the last 4 years regarding trying to prevent foreclosure and to helping people who are facing foreclosure get through the process, and we've got the counseling in place. This bill keeps the counseling in place, but it says that you may have the opportunity after you've done the counseling to request mediation with your lender, whoever holds the mortgage note. And that's been a real issue, particularly for the securitized loans that are off who knows where, and trying to get someone even on the phone to talk to discuss negotiating that if the counselors are going down that road has proved to be really difficult. So the bill last year, and by the way, this is an initiative from the Attorney General's office, and the bill last year had a structure set up within the AG's office to provide this mediation, and it would be paid for in last year's bill by a $125 fee on all foreclosure filings, or the notice of foreclosures. So whether or not you went to mediation, the lender would have to pay the $125 fee to, or the holder of the mortgage to, would have to pay that fee, and then it would go into a fund to fund this operation within or under the AG's control, not necessarily within her office, but it would be a structure set up by her.
Chairman,
this bill.
Mr. Chairman, who pays the $125 fee?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
The lender.
Mr. Chairman, that was last year's proposal, and I'm going to tell you, those are the two things that we have changed, and I should have said that. I should have prefaced my comments about that. The structure within the AG's, or under the AG's jurisdiction, and the $125 fee that would have been paid by everyone filing a notice of foreclosure, whether or not they went to mediation. That's changed now in this form, and that happened in Senator Tomasoni's division, and instead of this being a structure under the jurisdiction of the Attorney General, by the way, whose idea this is, we instead have moved it under the Office of Administrative Hearings. So, and they have they testified even last year that they wanted to be involved. And so instead of being within the authority of the Attorney General, the way the bill stands now, it would be with the Office of Administrative Hearings. And they are very enthusiastic about doing that. They're already in place. They have a good solid system. And there's no need, perhaps, to reinvent that wheel. The other issue that's changed, and I think that addresses some of the governor's concerns, that first point, moving it to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The second point, and I hope it addresses the governor's concern, is that now we would pay for these mediations. They would be specific to the mediation itself, to that homeowner and that holder of the mortgage, and they would each pay $160 because that's the statutory fee that the Office of Administrative Hearing charges, $160 an hour. And they feel, the OAH feels that most of these would probably go about 2 hours. So only the people who are actually in mediation pay, and only the holders of the mortgages who are in mediation pay. It doesn't affect everybody else. The county recorders were very concerned about that $125 add-on to their already very uniform $47 fee. And so they spoke in Senator Tomasoni's division. This we've met with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and actually that's with Mr. Krause and Mr. Johnson, Bruce Johnson, I think, who's the assistant or associate of the OAH, and also the Bureau of Mediation Services. They would like to be involved. I don't know if they will be, but it would be through the OAH. And so I think that, therefore, and I haven't looked real recently, but there should be no fiscal impact because this is going to be, this is within,
Mr. Mosman.
Mr. Chair and members, excuse me, Senator Scheid is certainly correct. What we had passed out is a preliminary fiscal note. It has been signed off by all of the agencies and executive budget officers other than the Attorney General, which I believe should have no cost at this point as their involvement has changed. And as you can see from the front of the fiscal note and as summarized in the subsequent pages, as detailed in the subsequent pages, is that the fees, again, because there's the $160 fee and then any additional charges that the Office of Administrative Hearings incurs are assessed back to the parties, has a net neutral cost because those fees will be covered by the parties involved. So the estimated expenditure for the Office of Administrative Hearings is $2,350, and that's offset, obviously, by revenues of that same amount for no fiscal impact. Yet.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mosman, when you look at that, the current funding of the OAH, the money is forwarded to the treasurer, state fund, and the administrative officers don't have access to that money.
Mr. Chair and Senator Foley, this money would go into the Office of Administrative Hearings account, which they have authority to spend from. These monies would be deposited into the Office of Administrative Hearings special account.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mosman, on the current way we're doing it, that isn't what happens. That part of the judiciary budget, the money comes in, all right, but it doesn't isn't balanced out.
I think it's in the bill that this is targeted, and it does go in that account, right? So it's different than the other money, Senator Foley. This goes directly into a specific account to pay for it. The way I understand it, the way I read it.
Mr. Mossman?
Senator, that's correct. And Senator Foley, if you look on page 9 of the division report, subdivision 10 on page 9 of the division report, you'll see that mediation fees collected by the office are deposited in the administrative hearings account in the state treasury and are appropriated to the office for the purposes of this section. So they are in this bill, any fees deposited into the account as a result of this activity are in this bill appropriated back to the office for the these purposes.
Mr. Chairman,
Chair Foley.
Perhaps we should look at how those things come out. I don't want separate ways of dealing with that. Senator Higgins perhaps has a better feel to what I'm trying to judge because he had that in the public safety judiciary budget.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
I think the OAH isn't in the judiciary budget. It's in
mine.
Your State budget. Departments.
It's not ours.
Thank you.
Further questions or discussion? Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, and if I get to the floor with this, I will have a kind of a little tweak of some language that has to do with banks and who might be exempt. But it's not a policy change. It's just that we're still working on language. Mr. Skilbred has been discussing that with me, but this isn't the appropriate place for that, but I just wanted to tell you, and I wanted him to know that we're still going to do some of that, but it won't change the policy.
Okay. Further discussion, questions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 2170 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay. On Senator Frederickson's motion, is there further discussion? Right. If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you very much.
Chairman, can I just make one brief point? I've looked at your bill and I've looked at the House version, and yours is much superior in my judgment than the House version. And I would hope that when you copy it out, you do the best job you can for the language that you have in, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might say that I don't see that the Senate would really go for anything, you know, backing off this position, because it's been Senator Tomasoni was gracious enough to give the bill a second hearing in his committee. So I believe that we'll come back. Otherwise, I don't think it would be signed, and I want a bill signed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Senator Scheid.
Thank you.
Okay, next we've got Senate File 2937, Senator Rosen. Senator Frederickson moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Rosen.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to be in front of your committee. I have Senate File 2937 in front of you. It's a chemical dependency treatment pilot project. And in 2009, we passed legislation that allows the county chemical dependency pilot project. And what this legislation did was it authorized the establishment of chemical healthcare home pilot projects to test a delivery redesign. And that's what we need to do now to hopefully find some cost savings and be able to deliver treatment in a more efficient, better way. The redesign would offer appropriate flexibility that ensures the timely access of these services, as well as better align the systems and services for the clients. So this bill, Senate File 2937, is legislation needed to clean up the actual implementation of last year's bill. It clarifies the start and end dates, it clarifies an evaluation component, creates a mechanism for financial risk sharing with counties, establishes an out clause for the participating counties. A work group was put together last year after the passing of the 09 bill, and it comprised of the county, of the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrator staff, and the Department of Human Services staff. And they brought together two pilot project locations, one in Washington County and one in the southeast corner of the state, including 10 counties down there. So the work group had been meeting to determine the eligibility criteria, and I can go more if you into that, but I don't think you want me to. And it's initially designed for the heavy users who use the where the usual service model is not working for them. And, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Kelly Harder with me, who can explain more about the finance part of this. There is a zero fiscal note on this bill.
Yeah, I know that there's a zero fiscal note relative to the state, but there's discussion about local government and inability to determine the cost for local government. So maybe you could offer just a little bit of advice on that.
Mr. Chair, and I will let, I'll turn Kelly, because he was part of the working group and he can explain this better, but basically they can't go over what they would already have been providing in the past, but they, it just allows the flexibility to use the funds in a different manner to serve these heavy users.
Okay, so there's no, so as I understand then, there's no imposition of costs on local governments. It's already what's there. Is that correct?
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Right.
It's just a better flexibility of using those dollars and maneuvering them around.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I've got a technical question on the division report. Page 1, line 24, there's a report to do to the legislative committees. We normally have it sent to the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees having jurisdiction over chemical health issues. And a second question I've got, though, Senator Rosen, the report is due by June 30th of 2013, which would be between legislative sessions. You know, we certainly have staff around here during them, but typically if a report comes in June of 2013, we can't do anything until January 2014. So is there a reason why you couldn't delay the report and have it at the start of the January 2014 session when, you know, it's fresh there, they can, the legislators are here, they can start working on it?
Mr. Chair, could I defer to Mr. Harder, please,
on that,
since he was part of the working group?
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to bring this bill in front of you. Specifically, Senator, answer to your question.
And I'm sorry, if you could just identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Kelly Harder, Human Services Director, Steele County, and co-chair for MACSA's Legislative Committee. And thank you once again for allowing us to come here with this bill. I can answer two questions on the financing as well as on the outcomes report. The program on here is slated to start July 1 of this year. It will run for 2 years with then a, for the purposes of collecting data and doing a thorough analysis on its effectiveness, it would bring you to the June report to the legislature, would be done at that time. We're also in the contracts that we're working out between the participating counties, pilot counties, and DHS. It's not to say that the program has to end. There can continue to be an arrangement between the department and the counties if it is working and we're measuring these outcomes that we are going to measure, which right now we measure one, whether they use more or less while in treatment. We're going to expand that to over 10 outcomes that affect the communities. We will be measuring that along the way. So there is an ability to continue the program if it is working. There's also obviously going to be out clauses if it isn't working. The working has to do with outcomes. It also has to do with the financial model, and so that we are given the flexibility. In turn, the counties are assuming responsibility for costs that might run over the consolidated fund. But this bill also allows us that if we manage it well and there are underspent dollars, it gets rolled into the next year and reinvested into this very same population.
Senator Benson.
Sure, I've got a more basic question than that. The 2013 legislative session will end in mid-May. Everybody's going to go home. There won't be any legislative staff. The staff will be here. Legislators are not going to be here. There's no committee meetings. There's nothing going on in the legislature. It won't start until January 2014. Now, so if you have a report submitted on June 30th of 2013, it will sit here for 7 months before anybody can do anything about it. Wouldn't it be better to have the report submitted in January of 2014 so you've actually got legislators here who can start acting on the report? Or do you want it just sitting on somebody's desk for 6 months? That's my question.
We could do January 2013 if you want. I guess.
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator, if it is the preferred by the committee, it could be January 2013. The program for evaluation is going to stop in July of 2012.
Okay.
Well, so when I have two full years, that would give you 6-7 months, if need be. I would prefer we address it then versus it another year post it being shut off to review that.
Well, Mr. Chair, well, for two motions, I guess the first one is the easier one. On page 1, line 24 of the division report, change legislative committees, and I'll have to defer to counsel to say that the chair and the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees having jurisdiction.
Okay. On that
I'll make that motion first.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, it sounds like it would on page 1, line 25 of the division report, change June 30 to January 15.
And on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Same year, though?
Same year. Apparently, yep. They want it earlier than later, so, yeah.
I'm sorry. I went too fast. Let's revote on that then with that clarification. On Sarah Betzel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, Senator, just to clarify your question, it's on page 2, line 14, about the expenditures coming from the state and from the counties. And then to clarify what Mr. Harder was saying about the special revenue account, if there is savings that will go into this special revenue account that will be held over for future pilot projects.
And as Mr. Harder was testifying, I caught that in reading through the bill, so appreciate that. Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, I move the Senate file 2937 as amended. You recommend it to pass and send it to the floor. Mr. Watson has got a.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I think there is a cross reference that should be corrected on page 1, line 32. It refers to subdivision 5, paragraph C, which it was in the bill as it came to the division, but in the division they added a new paragraph A. So what used to be C is now D.
Mr. Watson, is that on page 2?
The language is on page 2,
okay.
But the reference is on page 1, line 32.
Yeah. So
I think the reference to paragraph C should be to paragraph D.
Senator Frederickson makes that.
Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Senator Frederickson makes that motion for the discussion. If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Then on Senator Frederickson's motion, that Senate file 2937 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Rose.
Thank
Mr.
you, Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Frederickson.
Okay, then next we have Senator Latz isn't here, and I indicated we would continue the agenda after the session. If we just have the one bill, we won't do that. We'll put that on.
Pardon?
Oh, okay. I guess he is here. So we have Senate file 2199, Senator Olson. And Senator Betzel moves adoption of the division report. Senator Betzel moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, get organized.
No, I know you were down or across the hall in K-12. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 2199 is a bill with a fiscal impact. You do have the fiscal note that just deals with us, the legislature. I introduced it early this year in this session. Without any co-authors, it shows me singly, but I will add that while I didn't ask anybody to co-author, the authorship is full and there is a waiting list, and it's bipartisan. Senator Clark and Senator Wieger and Senator Roebling and Senator Sieben and Senator Rest all asked to be join me in it. It does two things. It reduces the size of the legislature, the Senate by 11 members and the House by 22 members. And the second thing that it does is that it makes Senate districts fit within congressional districts so that we don't have any overlapping there. That little inspiration kind of came to me as we were listening to the census
and the potential of or losing a congressional district. There are currently 8, as you know, and there could be 7. The number of 56 members is divisible by either number. So we could keep that second principle of all Senate district boundaries fitting within a congressional district, whatever the result of the census is. This would take place after the next redistricting. Why am I proposing it? Why do I think we should pass it? And why now? Well, I think it isn't necessary for us to be, we like being number one in some things, but we do have the largest Senate in the country. Never mind population. We are number one. There are some supporting pieces that I have made available. I think they're in your packets that identify some different comparisons with states based on population as well as geography. And you might take a look at those. The House is not the largest. I think New Hampshire claims that because I think they must have a representative for every section of land, and or maybe every city block. And
I think New Hampshire is considered to be a throwback to the old town meeting days.
So that is one reason. And I believe this proposal is not a drastic one. I think there have been others in the past that have cut far more substantially. I felt a modest reduction was more in order. For many of us, the size of the new district isn't as large as what we've ended up a decade with if you live in a growing area. It does save us money. And reflection on the times that we're in and what we're trying to do, we're requiring a lot of entities to face cuts in revenue. And it seems to me that maybe we should look at our own house as well. There's downsizing throughout, you know, industry, looking at trying to increase productivity. There's a symbolic aspect to it that if we would lead forth in it, cutting what I believe Senator Roebling did some calculation, that it amounts to about a 5 or 6% cut, you know, in terms of our budget and our overall personnel for our Senate, is not unreasonable. And I think that last time I checked, our governmental bodies are not the most popular things in the world. I don't think we rank above used car salesmen yet. And I think part of that comes from the belief that we would never do anything that would, you know, that would be not in our self-interest. And because there's been a few comments of some of the press that have picked it up, because I have not pushed this. I've not been trying to push this either as a partisan issue or as a political issue. I think it's a kind of an internal issue for us to decide. But they think it just won't happen because why we wouldn't do that to ourselves. But why not? Our times are different now. Many of us are in this technological age. Some of us, on this committee, tend to be probably more of the immigrants to technology than the natives to it. Some have adapted and taken it on much more readily than others. But the natives are coming. There are retirements that are happening within our group this year, and there will be, as there always is at the time of redistricting, more. So it can be a time of transition. And I think that when you see what many of us have seen happen with technology in terms of, I remember the visions of the humongous bill binders that you could hardly lift from below your desk to get onto and to examine all of our bills. And we have gone virtually paperless, not totally, But that has cut down on, that's improved our efficiency. And I think the same will be true in terms of our communications. It's happened with our constituents. Much more is being done by email than regular mail or some other means. And even the interaction, you know, we don't want to lose contact with our constituents, and that's going to be more challenging in some parts of the state than others because of proximity and the geographical challenges that some face. But I was watching, I caught a part of the of your DFL state convention, but a couple weeks before, on Almanac, they were interviewing the Duluth mayor and brought up a really clear picture of him. There was no time lapse in terms of the sound. Conversation was going back and forth. And I think I can see a day not too far away that kind of capacity would be here, even within our Senate media, to be able to sit down and be able to interact and talk with a group in whatever town, in whatever part of the state. And so I think our communications are improving, and the ability to do that mitigates some of the challenges of increased geography. But the reality is that our districts will still, if you look at it in comparison with what other states have, either geography or population-wise, they are, we have it very, very easy, or we are much smaller by virtue of the numbers that we have. So that is the reason I brought this forward. And, somebody said it was not going to go anywhere. Senator Duress didn't think she should even bother giving a hearing. She did do that. And it has come through two committees, and here it is in finance. I think there's some that feel that this discussion should continue. And so I just bring it before you for your consideration and hopefully your support.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had been gathering a lot of information about the possibility of doing this and had written a bill that had called for 50 senators and 100 representatives. And then I heard Senator Olson had already introduced one. And I discarded mine and went on to hers, thinking I really like the congressional districts being fitted into evenly into Senate districts, and the number 56 seemed like it would probably be a more passable number in the Senate. But there were times when we actually had this amount of legislators. In 1891, there were, and our Senate and House size have changed a number of times over the years. I think about 13 times. We had 114 House seats and 54 Senate seats for a total of 168, which is very close to what is being proposed here today. And, Wisconsin is similar in size to us. Actually, they have 400,000 more people, but it has 69 fewer legislators. And since 1960, 19 states have reduced the size of their legislatures. And the other issue for me was I probably represent about the largest Senate district in the state right now before redistricting. And I think it's doable. I have over 100,000 constituents. And using the numbers that Senator Olson is proposing in the bill, and population figures from last time we each had 73,000, and this would be bringing us up to about 93,000 constituents each. And I have a House member, Representative Beard, in House Senate District 35A, and he has about 57,000 constituents right now, and it's manageable. And so I just want to assure you that it's not something that we can't accomplish, even if we have more constituents in our districts. And so I've been advocating for it, and it actually, the fiscal note says it would save $3.1 million a year. I actually think it might be a little higher than that. But I was reading something from the Council of State Governments, and it was talking about what legislators were doing in other states because of their budget deficits. And a lot of them were doing things like 10% cuts in their pay and their constituent services and things like that. If we did something like this, we could probably forego that, because we would be able to take this reduction and just by reducing our numbers. And I think we have to look ahead. I think we have to realize that our revenues are probably not going to rise back to the level they were a few years ago anytime soon. So we are going to have to think about more reductions in our own budget. And this would help deal with that issue.
Senator Thomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Robley, I always like when you lay out the argument for why I should be against the bill, because you pointed out how the districts will suddenly all be in the Twin Cities and there won't be anything in rural Minnesota, and there will be very little representation out in rural Minnesota because of the population. And, you know, I put like 30,000 miles a year on my car right now. My district is not one of the bigger ones in rural Minnesota. It's only about 70 miles square. Senator Saxog's district is 300 miles long. I don't know how big Senator Bach's district is. It's huge. I know that. And when you talk about communication and having the ability to communicate with people via computers or email or whatever you want, I love listening to my Representative Rukavina talk about trying to download a picture at his place where he can go out and cut a cord of wood and come back into the house and maybe the picture is downloaded because they don't have DSL and he can't get fast service out where he lives. And so representing the people in rural Minnesota is still an issue and still a problem. And cutting the size of the legislature in the way this is proposed is a definite disadvantage to people coming in from rural Minnesota. And the representation of the people in rural Minnesota becomes more and more difficult. And I believe that for the people out there who think that this is a part-time job, try representing people in rural Minnesota and try doing it part-time, and you'll find that you have no time to yourself right now, and it is virtually a full-time job to make the districts even bigger and to ask that we represent even more people in a larger area would make this virtually a full-time job, and we would have to discuss the possibilities of that also. So I oppose your bill. Just in case you haven't understood what I was just getting at.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I have a concern in a different area. In the inner city, we have a lot of diverse populations, and I think having larger districts would dilute our ability to elect people. I mean, in my district, I potentially could elect, or in St. Paul, certainly a Hmong person, as we have Senator Moi. We have a Latino, we have Representative Carlos Mariani, we had Cy Tao, we have running for the legislature in Cy Tao's seat two African-Americans in the primary. And I'm interested in, you know, I think it also might hurt the ability of more women to get elected. We're not at parity yet in the we're about 40% in the Senate, but much less in the House. So, you know, that's my concern with your legislation.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, the thing that I like about Senator Olson's proposal is number 56. It's so nice that if we have eight congressional districts, it still works out with having the eight into the 56. And if we wind up with seven congressional districts, it still works out. So it's a nice number.
Yeah, thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, if I just might respond, I don't know, you know, our districts would still be relatively small in relation population-wise than what other states are doing, and I don't think that they have necessarily precluded the diversity aspect of it. I think we are naturally becoming quite diverse, and part of the challenge is in the redistricting, if the guidelines are followed, federally, there's supposed to be attention paid to the communities of interest. You know, some of it's compactness, yes. That's hard to compact when you have a large geographic area, but we still are one person, one vote. And the only reason it would shift to another area is that people have moved or the population hasn't grown. And I think it doesn't reduce our responsibility in any legislative body to look out for our entire state. Some of us just came from the Minnesota prayer breakfast with our former colleague, Senator Ramstead, was the chair of it, and it was about unity, and it was a wonderfully diverse program and challenge of our needing to be unified in our approach and the work that we do for, toward the values that we all share, regardless of what party we are or whatever. If those communities of interest and even in making those, drawing those lines to assure that there can be representation, it hasn't precluded that we have a person of color in the Congress. You know, they may go to seven. Their districts are going to get bigger too, because our population isn't decreasing; it's growing. It's the sharing across countries that may cause us to lose a seat. So they're going to jump by a very large amount. And we have, you know, I think women are becoming competitive. I think some of the male population is a little apprehensive about women actually taking it over. I don't know that that will happen, but I don't think that those have to be the barriers of this fairly modest increase in sizes of districts.
Senator Roebling, I'm curious. You mentioned Wisconsin. What are the numbers in Wisconsin?
Let's see if I can find them again. Wisconsin has 5.5 million, according to the last census. And they have a House size of 99 and a Senate size
33.
Of 34, or 33 compared to our 67, so it's less than half.
Senator Pariseau.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out, Senator Pappas, your comparison lacks terrible weight for me, because you mentioned three people who were culturally diverse as well as three women. And so your point was kind of the opposite when you summed up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's under our current system. My concern is that if we have larger districts, it would be more difficult to elect women and people of color.
I don't see that changing, because if the boundaries are expanded, they expand equally to everybody.
So no, they combine.
Well,
they should combine.
Mr. Chair?
Not necessarily.
Mr. Chair?
Searles.
You know, what I see in the our colleagues, diversity in whatever area, is they're electing very competent people. And I think if competent people are running, ones that can relate well to people, they are winning. And I think that's what adds to the richness that we have. I don't think that has to make a difference. But I can understand some of the apprehensions that we have. But there has been a lot of progress made, and they've added great quality to the diversity that women. I mean, there were many fewer women when I was first elected as well. Many of you have joined the ranks since that time, and I don't think that's going to change.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, think that what I like best about this is that it's a modest approach. It's not, you know, slicing it in half or anything like that. But I think when I think about the rural areas, and Senator Tomasoni, you brought this up, one of the shortcomings right now under the current system is pay, I think, for any young professional. You can't go into it. And the other one is the resources. If you have the ability to raise a lot of money for your campaign so you can spend it, I mean, you take a district like mine, I've got 23 papers in the district, and that's true in most of the rural districts. If you want to cover that district so that you keep people informed, you really need resources. And so I think right now the way the system is, it's almost impossible for us to get plug resources back into, to our budget or to our technology or to anything, because things are so, and it gets difficult. But I think if you reduce the legislature, maybe at the same time you could probably increase the resources that legislators had to work with, such as, some kind of a fund like we do for technology, telephone, increase that up. I don't know about you, but when I get the phone bills in the end of the month, I think I spend, $200-$300 every month. I mean, you got to have a cell phone, you got to have internet service, you got to have, they're all different. And then if you want to stay in touch and find out, keep knowing what's going on in the different communities, you should have to have a subscription to every paper. You need to have, you know, other kinds of resources. So I think it would be a good trade-off to look at this and then maybe in combination in the back of our minds maybe look at making when if and when that happens, making the push to help legislators handle the workload a little bit better.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I've heard about the Wisconsin comparison many times, and my legislative assistant worked for me for just over a year, and she worked previously for the Wisconsin State Senate. And so I think one thing what you need to keep in mind with the Wisconsin State Senate is they get paid twice as much as we do. According to my legislative assistant, many of them have district offices with perhaps five or six employees per legislator, per senator. And so I haven't seen what the total bill is over there, but I'm sure it's much higher than ours. On top of that, they meet or are expected to be meeting 11 months of the year. It's a full-time legislature. So there's that comparison that has some things we should also take into consideration.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with most of what Senator Tomasoni and Senator Stumpf have said. And I would also like to note that all of the author and the co-authors are all from a metropolitan area. There are no rural senators as
Senator Clark,
authors of this bill. That's the St. Cloud area. The district that I happen to represent is in the middle of the state, southern Minnesota. It's over 100 miles long, and at the widest part of the district, it's probably about 60 miles wide. There are no four-lane highways in the district other than a couple miles near Marshall. To make that district even larger would make the legislature even more remote from the citizens of the district. And I don't think it would help with promoting a better impression of the legislature. I think it would make the legislature even more remote and make people even more cynical.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I look at this more of a and I guess I won't use those words. I think we need to. My district is big. I represent six counties. And I can start out in the morning, and I have to figure it out, so I stop in those towns so I don't go there and back. It's not just big distance in northern Minnesota. It's also out where I live. And I wore out four cars, and I'm going on my fifth one now, just traveling back and forth. People want you to come and talk to them. They don't want to talk to you on the phone. You want to get reelected, you better get out there and be have hands on one. They want to talk to you about it. I don't see any problem with, if you really want to change things, why does the House get the same kind of money that I do and I got to do it twice the district? Well, yeah, then they come, well, we got to run. That's got nothing to do with it. I have to do twice the work, the same amount of money that the House gets. And I'm not going to get into that, but I don't want to ever, and I'm leaving, so it doesn't make much difference to what some of you do, but don't take away the rural representation. I fear that. That's what I fear. You can sit here in the cities in certain spots, and all of your constituents are within one or two blocks. Mm. Mine are worth 200 or 300 million.
Well, 1 or 2 miles.
Senator Pappas, has that described your district?
I know, I'd say 1 or 2 miles, at least.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think everybody kind of understands where the rub is here. You know, Senator Vickerman's comment, you know, all your constituents were within two blocks. That's the way it seems like when you've got a district that's the size of Tomasoni's or Vickerman's or Fredrickson's or Leroy Stumps, who's, that thing looks like Utah. But, you know, if you really want to build efficiencies around here, and I'm not saying that the system that we have right now is not efficient, but it could be improved. But it's going to cost some money to make that happen. When I was first in the legislature, I brought in this bill because I thought I knew more than what I really did. Maybe I still am that way. And it would have cut the legislature almost in half. After all these professionals from the University of Minnesota got done with me, I realized that cutting it in half and making it a full-time legislature with appropriate pay, appropriate staff, much along the line of the Wisconsin model, was going to cost us more. I believe that it's probably a better way to go because this is a full-time legislature. We are just kidding each other if we don't think it is. And in greater Minnesota, Senator Vickerman's just right. He ran out four cars. The car I just got rid of had 278,000 miles on it. My pickup truck had just about 300,000 miles on it. And people in the country, they want to see your face. And they don't want to see it on their computer screen in some internet hookup. They want you right there, and you have to be there. But if you want to build efficiencies, you got to cut the legislature at least in half or get rid of the other body.
Oh, that's good.
I like that.
I don't think anybody around here is going to be disagreeable with that.
Where's Governor Ventura?
Well, Jesse's probably going to make an appearance this evening.
No beads. If you're going to build efficiencies, you either got to get rid of one body or you got to go to a full-time legislature, and you only need 90 members. But you have to understand that it's going to be expensive because people that are still going to be here, like Senator Stumpf, are going to have to hire staffs at the expense of the state to take care of their district because now instead of the size of Utah, it's the size of Texas and Alaska. This is a modest step towards the approach, and it will save us a little bit of money. But in the long term, we're probably going to rack it up in mileage that people use. And, I read the fiscal note. That wasn't in there. And we do get reimbursed from time to time.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Sarah Olson. Well,
Mr. Chair, I was reflecting on some of the trade-offs you've been talking about. When you're talking about going to a full-time legislature, now if and what the relevance might be of our making a decision to try to just slim down slightly the size of the current one, if we were going to go full-time, I do believe that would take a constitutional amendment. If we're going to meet more than 120, at least in session, we've got a restriction that we're having a bit of a challenge now. We probably wouldn't have a hard time getting that passed to go to the public. Do you think the public wants us over here full time?
100%
of the time. No. I don't think it does hurt to show that we can show some restraint ourselves and find ways to cope with these other states that have got 33 in the Senate. Some of their geography is, it may not be quite as diverse as ours, but it's just as large. And I think, we're still, all of us are still thinking in our own immigrant to technology mindset. I can't help it. It's a full-time job for me. I don't live out way out in the country, but I'll tell you, I've got a lot of lakeshore in bays and things, and people, you can get lost out there. I've learned my way around it, but people do want to see you at functions, and I'm amazed when you go to things, even in an area that is kind of suburban, the word gets around that you're there. Mm-hmm. I thought of that more as what happens in your rural communities, but it's all over. So it doesn't take away. I don't care where we are, whether we have a somewhat more a dense population. We find ways and we learn to manage so that we can keep that personal contact. And pretty soon, it's here now. You can be talking on the phone and be transmitting that. That phone is going to be, that communication and that personal touch is growing technology-wise more than we even can envision. It seemed far-fetched a few years back, and it's happening. It's happening. So I think this is manageable, and it may be also a step that would help in some of the other changes we feel that would be good for the way in which our legislature functions in the future.
Okay, we're under call, but I've been told we can continue and to finish our agenda, both Senator Olson and Senator Lass. Senator Wieger?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, thank you for your efforts. I support it. I think it's a very thoughtful, moderate, reasonable approach, and clearly the majority of Minnesotans would support it as well.
Senator Roblin.
And I just want to remind members, you know, technology has changed so fast in the last 10 years, and it's going to change really fast in the next few again. I mean, it's just amazing. And we can only do this once every 10 years. We only have the option with redistricting once every 10 years. So to think about changing our numbers is a unique opportunity that not even everyone in the legislature will ever get to vote on unless they're here for that time period.
We'll manage.
Senator Thomson.
Senator Roebling, when they get that Star Trek technology where they can beam me from one place to the next just like that, then I can maybe support something like this. But it takes quite a while to get around in Minnesota, in rural Minnesota.
Okay, Senator Barroso.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to speak up in favor of the bill because I look at the people who I hear from here are not necessarily all within the boundaries of my district, although I do hear from them a lot, and we have a lot of visitors on campus because they're more – accessible to the area, a lot of students, of course. But in spite of that, I still get calls from people. Do you have all of Senator Murphy? I'm not sure. Do you have all of Wabasha County?
No.
Well, I get calls from the eastern end of Wabasha County from people whose calls go back to when I was working in a U.S. senatorial office, and they continue to call me almost every year. I hear from them all the time, and sometimes on the same issues or the same things that are going on in my district, but that's two counties east of me. So at any rate, and I get a lot of calls from, because of the issues I tend to work on and pick up on and am known for, from all parts of the state, especially the north country and the rural parts, because it's either agriculture-related or sportsman-related. So, you know, I don't just hear from people within my own boundaries. And I'm sure you're not, I'm sure everybody here has that same experience sometime.
Further discussion? If not, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2199 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Division.
Okay, request for division. All those in favor, if you could please raise your hand. And opposed?
Anybody counting?
Okay. The vote is 7-7 without Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chair, did you vote?
I vote yes. Senator Murphy, did you wish to vote on this bill?
Oh, great.
That many has to take the vote again, or are you just going to say never mind?
I'm sure I'm going to hear about this tonight.
Yes, you will.
I should right. Vote yes.
Okay, motion carries 8-7. Thank you, Senator Olson. Okay, next we
Thank
have
you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Latz, Senate File 3246. And again, it's been indicated that we can.
Did this go to Rules Committee?
No. I think we'll go to the floor.
To the rules committee.
Let's go to the rules
committee. Would like to see it.
I would amend my motion to include the rules.
Oh, you want to include.
Okay, well.
It has to go to rules.
It would do that anyway, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, voting on the prevailing side, I.
No, I don't
no it's going to go to rules anyway.
It'll go to rules.
It'll go
no
to rules
what,
anyway.
So.
Sooner or later, somebody will push it to rules.
That was not the motion. Now we've lost people.
Oh, Lance is waiting in the wings. That's right. I forget Lance is waiting in the wings.
Okay. Let me indicate. The motion was, I didn't realize there was a request from the Rules Committee. The motion was, on Senator Olson's bill, was to send the bill to the floor. That motion prevailed. And that's where the bill is going. We've lost people now. What was an even vote.
It will get reviewed.
So if Senator Pogamiller wants the bill in rules, he can make the motion. Senator Olson, you'd have an objection to that.
I'll take care of that.
Okay. All right. Then Senate File 3246, the claims bill, Senator Latz. And let me indicate to members before Senator Latz proceeds with Mr. Lindeke that obviously this has, I think, a little under $100,000 because we always have a claims bill. We budget for the claims bill. And so this bill is taken into account with where the budget is. So, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This bill, I'm hoping, will be a bit less controversial than the last one, less divisive anyway, in terms of votes than the last one. This is the annual claims bill. It consists of several parts. There are regular claims that come before the Claims Committee through the Department of Corrections for reimbursement, basically for injuries that occur while inmates in the state correctional system or persons on community work service or sentenced to service out in Minnesota get injured while performing that work. They are reimbursed on the workers' compensation schedule for whatever injuries they receive. If they cut off the end of a finger working in the kitchen with a knife, then the degree of incapacitation is determined by the work comp schedule, and that's if we determine it's appropriate, they get reimbursed. There is a unique piece of I should say the ones that are under $500, the department just takes care of on their own, and we add them up and reimburse them. There are ones greater than that amount which come before the committee for consideration. Those that we have agreed to recommend for reimbursement are contained in Section 1 of the bill with the names and the individual amounts. I'm only going to highlight one of them for you, and that is on line 1.28, item J, Chad Westring. That is a total payment of over almost $14,000. He was working on sentence to service in Todd County, and a tree fell on him. So he suffered some significant injuries, and that accounts for that.
Can I ask Senator Latz on that one? I don't think I've seen this before. What? And that's the payment to medical providers. So with these other kinds of claims with prisoners, I don't think I've seen a claim for the medical expenses.
Mr. Chairman, I ask Mr. Lindeke to respond to the question.
Mr. Chair, that is a sentence to service person. So they had to come out with an ambulance. They took him to a hospital and treated him. He's not in prison. The ones that are in prison, of course, we don't pay medical costs to the providers because they're already taken care of by the department.
All right, thanks. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman and members, the other and most significant portion of the bill before you is Section 2, relating to the Office of the Court Administrator. There was only one person in the Senate that we knew of that actually had some history for us that would tell us there's some precedent in this area, and that's Mr. Watson, Senate counsel, who many years ago was the counsel for the Claims Committee. What we have here is a situation where an individual was rightfully convicted but incarcerated for the wrong period of time. Incarcerated for over 300 days longer than he should have been. And it turns out there are a number of errors along the way that resulted in this. The court services probation department that worked up the pre-sentence investigation and the recommendation didn't put in the correct criminal history score for the consecutive sentence to which Mr. Hines was being sentenced. Ordinarily, his criminal history score would have been 7, but when it's a permissive consecutive sentence under the sentencing guidelines, that 7 becomes a 0 for purposes of the consecutive sentence that's imposed. The difference between a 7 and a 0 there was between a 25-month presumptive commit and a 1 year and a day sentence. So he ended up serving quite a bit longer than he was supposed to. The judge didn't pick it up in the district court. The prosecutor and the public defender's office did not pick it up at sentencing. When the defendant appealed the case, it was the prosecutor on the appeal that picked it up and noted it in the footnote, the final footnote of the appellate brief. The public defender's office on appeal then saw it and agreed with that, but neither the prosecutor nor the appellate public defender sought immediate release or an expedited review on appeal or anything like that. So during the entire appellate process, Mr. Hines continued to be incarcerated wrongfully. You know, by that time, he had already served the 8 months that he would have served under 1 year and 1 day had that been the correct original sentence. So by the time all of this sorted out, he got released, having served, I think it was about 380-some extra days, 389 days longer, over a year longer than he should have served had he been correctly sentenced. When this came up, we did some research around the country to determine how other states handle these kind of situations, and not at that time knowing that we even had a history in Minnesota of dealing with cases that where there was a wrongful incarceration. There are statutes in 22 states that deal with wrongful convictions. And the way they handle those range everywhere that you might expect, from the least generous state says if you're wrongfully convicted, no matter how long you wrongfully serve, you will get reduced tuition at higher education institutions in that state as your compensation. There are other states that simply say fair and reasonable compensation is the amount. One state has $1 million cap. Some states don't have any statute, so they get dealt with either through their tort claims process or through special bills in the legislature on a case-by-case basis. I know we're short on time, so I'll be quick to tell you that we used Iowa as our reference point. Iowa's statute has a $50 per day that you serve wrongfully, plus lost wages up to a cap of $25,000. So after sorting all of that out, figuring out his lost wages and the wrongful number of days that he served, we came up with the figure that you have before you, which is about $34,000. And I anticipate that I will be introducing legislation to put a statute in place to give us better guidance in the future. But we thought that was a fair approach. There are some additional conditions to him accepting that money from the state, those are listed in paragraphs B and C on page 2 of the amendment. One is that money that he owes for restitution in connection with the crimes that he has committed will be deducted from that. And the second piece is that he will sign a release giving up any and all claims against the state or political subdivisions or any individuals that were involved in his wrongful incarceration. And so he won't be able to sue separately over this. This will be it.
So did he consider a legal malpractice claim? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, we're not aware that he has. The public defender's office has certain immunities as well as a political entity of the state.
You mean lawyers?
Public defenders
representing a client are immune from malpractice suits?
I couldn't give you the law on that, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hines did not bring that up, and we did not bring that up either. If you were to bring a claim against a variety of the political entities that were involved, there are pretty significant legal hurdles of immunities that a claimant could seek. The original wrongful decision maker was the judge who sentenced him. She didn't catch it. And it's almost impossible to sue a judge for damages. In this case, it was crystal clear that the fault was not that of Mr. Hines. It was the fault of others in the system. So I'm comfortable with what we're proposing to do here. There may be other situations where you've got wrongful convictions, where you've got contributory fault or comparative fault, and we're not having to deal with that here.
You know, they're waiting for us upstairs, so I don't want to belabor this. Was Mr. Hines represented by counsel in dealing with the claims committee?
Mr. Chairman, no, he was not. He represented himself.
Sir Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, as the I used to have the position that Senator Latz has, and this had to have been a nightmare. We had a similar instance that it didn't deal with a length of incarceration, but a very difficult issue as well, and it's not very much fun. I think this is probably about as fair as it's going to get, and as long as the individual is willing to sign the stipulations in Section 2, I think that this is as fair as it's going to get, and I think you guys did a good job. So I move the bill, Mr. Chairman.
And you should move the amendment first.
Oh, there is an amendment? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, we introduced a bill with as a placeholder.
Yeah. And
so delete everything.
Just on the delete everything amendment, the 2524 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. And I'm sorry, Senator Betzold had moved the amendment. And I would agree, obviously, Senator Latz, I know the thorough job you do on legislation, and obviously, Mr. Lindeke, relative to the claims work. I'm a little bit concerned, because it seems to me, and I'm not sure about governmental immunities, but if we have a probation office involved where there's a county employee, I understand the immunity of a judge, but it seems to me Mr. Hines might have secured a more significant settlement and or jury verdict if he had been represented by counsel and had looked at a malpractice policy, say in the case of the public defender's office. I can't remember my public defender days, but there has to be malpractice coverage for the actions of a public defender. They can't be immune from anything like that. I would think that wouldn't be the case. So,
Mr. Chairman, I don't agree with that at all. It seems to me that the sovereign immunity applied up to a certain point, and we, through court cases, why we've moved away from the sovereign immunity, and I agree with your thoughts on the providing counsel. It does seem rather unfair not to do that.
Okay. Sir Betzold.
No, let's wrap up.
I'll move the bill.
Senator Murphy moves the bill.
All right, Senator Murphy moves that Senate File 3246 as amended be recommended pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Lance, Mr. Lindeke, and
thank you.
Please adjourn.